Welcome to a series of podcasts brought to you by Yale University.
In this lecture, Jonathan Macy, Yale Law School class of 1982, delivers his inaugural lecture as the Sam Harris Professor of Corporate Law, Corporate Finance, and Securities Law on Where's the Theory in Corporate Governance.
One of the distinctive features of the Yale Law School that I truly love is the quality of the discourse in an interdisciplinary way between students and faculty constitutional law, corporate law, law and economics, behavioral economics, philosophy, psychology, who find common ground for intellectual discourse and can truly learn from one another. And my remarks today are really inspired by the issue that I'm currently wrestling with in my research, which is the extent to which we as corporate law scholars have a great deal to learn from the works that the research that our colleagues have done, particularly in the area of constitutional theory. And the starting point for this kind of analysis, of course, today in the wake of Enron, WorldCom, Adelphia, Tyco, Parmalat, et cetera, should, I think, naturally be the idea expressed by Madison in Federalist 10 that enlightened statesmen will not always be at the helm of government. And I think that we can start on an uncontroversial note by saying that I think it's fairly straightforward that this sentiment could be extended in a straightforward way, not only to constitutional theory, but to the notion that enlightened statesmen also will not be at the helm of U.S. Corporations, as we have seen in recent years. My talk basically looks at the extent to which our theories about corporate governance can be reconciled with very basic, well-known ideas in constitutional theory. In particular, I will look at four of the most important institutions of corporate governance: the market for corporate control, the jurisdictional competition for corporate charters, shareholder voting, and most importantly, the role in corporate governance of corporate boards of directors, and examine the extent to which this basic insight that enlightened statesmen will not always be at the helm of government is reflected in these mechanisms and institutions of corporate governance. The other point that I want to make about corporate governance from a constitutional theory perspective is that we learn in constitutional theory to think about government as a system of checks and balances in which no individual component, such as the judiciary or the press or the Congress or the executive, should be considered in isolation. Protestations by the current executive branch to the contrary notwithstanding. One of the questions that I want to look at today is the extent to which we don't really very well follow that basic instruction to take a systemic approach to corporate governance the way that our colleagues in constitutional theory take a systemic approach to their field of research. We tend to look at these individual aspects, these individual mechanisms like the market for corporate control or corporate boards of directors in isolation. And we've say, and in corporate scholarship reflects this kind of isolationist approach in which our articles will say, well, to what extent does shareholder voting solve the problems of corporate governance? To what extent does the market for corporate control solve the problems of corporate governance? And the fact is that that's really the wrong question. It is, how do these various pieces fit together, and how are the weaknesses in one of these mechanisms and institutions compensated for by strengths in another area. So to start with the very first, the market for corporate control, it's widely considered to be, particularly by financial economists ranging from Henry Manny to Andre Schleifer, as a critical role, it's playing a critical role in corporate governance, and certainly it does, and I would take second place to no one in saying that takeovers and mergers and particularly hostile acquisitions play an important role in corporate governance. But one of the things we clearly learned from the recent spate of corporate scandals is that the market for corporate control has to be viewed as a relatively small, if not insignificant, part in the corporate governance, in serving the corporate governance objective of mitigating corporate fraud, because the theory of the market for corporate control is an arbitrage theory that says that when companies are poorly managed, the market price for the shares will be efficient, therefore it will be depressed, and therefore there will be arbitrage possibilities by monitors, bidders, seeking out those companies, bidding and effectuating a change in management control in order to realize the gains associated with installing new management and then selling the shares at a higher price. Of course, where you have financial statements for a corporation that do not fully and fairly reflect the financial condition of the company, such that the share price is too high, there are no arbitrage profits. There are no arbitrage profits to be had in buying up Enron stock at $80 a share and exposing the fraud and selling the stock when the stock moves to its correct level of 2 cents or zero or 17 cents or wherever it happens to be trading this week on the pink sheet. So, however much we like the market for corporate control, and I like it quite a lot, and how effective we think it is, it's got to be viewed as part of a corporate governance system and probably a small part. The jurisdictional competition for corporate charters, similarly, is a very effective component in the corporate governance system. However, we have to observe the fact that it is also, not besides being highly effective, it is also highly prone to being usurped. That is to say that we live in a constitutional world in which Congress can come along and through Sarbanes-Oxley, whenever it wants, as a constitutionally uncontroversial matter, displace federalism, displace the jurisdictional competition for corporate charters at the local level, and that state legislatures are clearly at the mercy of Congress, which is going to limit the degrees of freedom that we observe state legislatures will have. I've talked briefly about shareholder voting, and shareholder voting recently, particularly, has been viewed as a sort of panacea in corporate governance. And I just will briefly point out that for at least 75 years, since Adolf Burley and Gardner Means' famous research on U.S. public corporations, we've known that shareholder voting is largely a myth in the public corporation and serves very limited roles in corporate governance as a descriptive matter for very clear reasons having to do with rational ignorance and free riding problems that have long been known. So last, I want to come to what is clearly the centerpiece of any examination of corporate governance, which is the roles of boards of directors in U.S. Corporate governance. And I want to make a couple of very basic sort of Federalist 10 points. Another observation that Madison observed in Federalist 10 was no man should be allowed to be a judge in his own cause, because his interest would certainly bias his judgment and not improbably corrupt his integrity. With equal, nay greater reasons, a body of men are unfit to be both judges and parties at the same time. This is a basic insight not only reflected in Federalist 10, but also in behavioral economics as well. And the question is, to what extent does our reliance on
corporate boards of directors consistent with this basic observation. And the core point that I want to make today is that, in my view, we do not, in corporate governance theory, remain faithful to this observation that comes straight out of basic constitutional theory. We have we indulge in the myth that corporate boards of directors can be both judges and parties at the same time. In particular, I want to focus our attention on the push and pull between the two models of corporate governance that are currently vying for our attention. One of these is the model that we've long had in corporate governance, historically, for the last 100 years at least, which is that corporate boards of directors, as a legal matter, have the formal power to run the corporation. And this was our simple view. They weren't thought of as being judges of behavior. They were thought of as participating actively in management in the strategic decisions made by a business. And this was a perfectly acceptable and non-controversial state of affairs for a very long time, actually for over 100 years until 1996. Prior to that point, courts, including the Delaware courts, had specifically rejected, in cases like Graham against Alice Chalmers, the idea that directors had an affirmative obligation to install systems of internal monitoring. And then, just really 10 years ago, in 1996, Chancellor Allen issued his now famous opinion in the Caremark derivative litigation lawsuit against the directors of Caremark, alleging that the directors had breached their fiduciary duty of care by failing to monitor effectively the conduct of corporate employees who violated various state and federal laws regulating payments to healthcare providers. And starting with the premise that increased increased federal law in the area of environmental regulations and healthcare regulations were imposing possible criminal penalties on corporations, and that corporations needed to monitor to monitor their employees in order to avoid running afoul of these statutes, the opinion presented really for the first time the notion that directors would be liable for losses caused by failure to consider whether to implement a system of corporate monitoring of performance. So we have this, and then we enter 2002 with Sarbanes-Oxley, which ratchets up significantly on boards of directors new monitoring responsibilities for corporate management, particularly the famous Section 404 of SOX, Sarbanes-Oxley, that requires management to establish and maintain adequate internal control structures and procedures, and requires audit committee of boards of directors to be responsible for overseeing the implementation and upkeep of these monitoring systems. So really, starting in 1996, not so long ago, but really since 2002, have we had in this country clearly emerge a corporate governance paradigm in which we think about corporate directors as simultaneously serving as advisors to senior officers about management and as monitors of management. And my basic argument is that this dual role for directors creates a fundamental, inescapable conflict for directors, because directors who are monitors inevitably are required to monitor themselves. When directors give advice, managerial advice, in time period one, they face a conflict in time period two, when they inevitably are called upon to evaluate decisions that were made by management wholly or partially on the basis of advice that they themselves earlier had provided. So we have this basic tension of the kind that that Federalist 10 clearly envisioned. these responses and this intense focus on boards of directors, I think, ignore a core lesson from the Enron debacle, which is that it's a bad idea to put too much reliance on any particular corporate governance mechanism, including the board of directors. And again, as I mentioned before, to look at corporate governance as a complex system of management and oversight monitoring, as opposed to a series of self-contained mechanisms and in institutions. It is a controversial idea that boards of directors are not competent or shouldn't be relied upon to play these dual roles. But in addition to finding support in constitutional theory, a great deal of research in both social psychology, behavioral law and economics, research in public choice, I think, all provide strong support for this idea. For example, the work of social psychologist in the idea of, for example, Tom Gilovich notion that beliefs are like possessions. When somebody challenges our belief, it is as if someone criticized our possessions. The notion that people internalize vocational role, occupational choices, such as the decision to accept a position on a corporate boards of directors, will shape our views and shape our attitudes. The work by Daniel Kahneman and Dan Lavallo on their description of what was known as the inside view, which look at things like parents' inability to view their children objectively or in a detached manner, is consistent with this idea, the notion that it's almost as difficult, I would urge, for boards of directors to objectively evaluate the performance of management, whom they've also chosen and retained and linked their own judgment to the performance of those people. So the idea is that here is not that I am suggesting a particular role for boards of directors. I'm suggesting that there are two possible models, an adversarial monitoring model or a collegial managerial model, and that firms should be free to choose for themselves which of these models to pursue. But as a matter of system design, it's unrealistic. It's unrealistic to think that boards of directors can simultaneously perform both of these functions. Now, those of you, my constitutional colleagues, may be thinking, correctly so, well, there's a problem here. There's a problem because we do observe that there are institutions in government that provide both managerial functions and monitoring functions simultaneously. Legislatures, for example. In fact, when Montesquieu coined the phrase checks and balances, the term checks was used by him specifically to refer to the monitoring function that each of the three branches of government was supposed to perform on the other branches. And what I want to consider now is the kind of the radical notion that as an institutional matter, as a structural matter, legislatures are likely to be far more successful at monitoring, say, the executive, than corporate boards of directors are at monitoring management. And I want to just mention two or three reasons why this might be the case. First, members of a legislature generally do not feel that they owe their jobs to the executive, in the same way that members of corporate boards of directors feel that they owe their jobs to management. In fact, it has been noted by Michael Jensen and other financial economists that, in fact, as a practical matter, boards of directors either owe or feel that they owe their positions as directors to management, which undermines their monitoring position relative to that which we think about as legislatures doing. A second and more important reason is that directors rely more on management for information then legislatures rely on the executive for information. It is not uncommon for members of Congress to generate the information necessary for making decisions by holding hearings, conducting their own independent investigations, often not only in isolation from the executive, but also in an adversarial manner in which the executive prefers that these investigations actually not occur. So legislatures, Congress, the modern Congress, is distinct from boards of directors in that they have the capacity and the inclination to generate information about performance of, say, the bureaucracy or the executive branch in ways that boards of directors do not have with respect to generating and process information about management of the corporation. So think about the full-time professional staff of legislatures, something incidentally that has been considered in the mid-1960s, Supreme Court Justice Arthur Goldberg, when he was a member of the board of TWA, proposed such an arrangement, and the response to him was to deny his request and to decline to nominate another term on the board of that company. Also, something to keep in mind, of course, is that we have in Congress, from a monitoring perspective, is that we don't have in the corporations is the party system. We have a competitive environment that allows members of the legislature who do not share the executive's party affiliation to have strong incentives to monitor the executive in order to identify and make political mileage from corruption or flaws in the executive's performance that the minority party or the congressional party can then turn to its own political advantage. In other words, Congress is often the training ground for politicians who aspire to displace the leader of the executive branch, whereas boards of directors are never populated with people who are, or very rarely, who are actual competitors for the position of corporate CEOs. Now, I want to add, particularly for my even more libertarian siblings, Bill and Rex, that my point here is not that legislatures are paragons of virtue and that we should model corporate governance systems from a design perspective on what we observe in Congress. My point, rather, is that boards are no better and likely to be structurally inferior as monitors, and that it's of executive performance. And so it may not be such a great idea from a corporate governance perspective to rely exclusively on, or even predominantly on, boards of directors to serve this monitoring function. So the idea is that kind of in an insidious way, this kind of decade-long addition of responsibilities for board of directors, adding on to the managerial function, this monitoring function, has, I think, exposed serious problems that deserve attention that we have not thus far really addressed from a corporate governance perspective, despite the fact that this is an issue that has long been of central importance to constitutional theorists. So I think that the basic takeaway argument that I'm making is that there is a necessity for investors to choose between a managerial board and a monitoring board, and no one has made the argument effectively, in my view, that it is possible for a board simultaneously to perform both functions, at least consistent with the basic assumptions about human nature that we see in Federalist 10. To think about some applications of this, just in closing, issue should be the very important question of how many independent directors, what percentage of a board of directors should be comprised of directors who are independent of management? And the answer to that question, I think, must depend on whether we want to have a managerial board or a monitoring board. As my colleague Roberta Romano observed in her exhaustive economic analysis of the effects of Sarbanes-Oxley, there are lots of studies that look at the relationship between board independence and performance and suggest that having too few insiders may be, in fact, counterproductive, as some financial economists have found that having a moderate number, say 3 to 5 insiders on a board, can produce better corporate performance than boards like, for example, Enron, which purport to be models of good corporate governance because they only have one. It had only one insider on the board. So the idea here is not that truly independent outside directors is a bad idea. Rather, the argument is that the current trend towards touting independent directors as a corporate governance panacea is misguided, and that we should view the board of directors as one and maybe not even a particularly important part of a complex system of corporate governance that is very dynamic, that includes private equity investors, hedge funds, the market for corporate control, arbitrageurs, and that it is a very bad idea to put too many eggs in the corporate in the basket of corporate board of directors. Thank you very much.
Jonathan Macy delivered this lecture at the Yale Law School on October 9th, 2006.